call Center Resources Committee meeting to order, February 13th. Time is 3:35. Members present, Senator Elton, Senator Dyson, myself, Senator Wagner, Chair, and Senator Stedman. There's two senators who won't be here at all today. Senator Stevens may be coming in a little later. Senator Kukesh and Senator Seekins won't be here. So it leaves a little shorthanded. First order of business is Senate Bill 166, Wildlife Conservation Tag. I'm going to hold that over until next Monday. And so we'll go to Senate Bill 213. It's appropriation for mineral inventory. Senator Perry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for scheduling Senate Bill 213 before the committee. I appreciate your consideration. I find it interesting today, the Fairbanks paper arrived in Oliver, or in our office today, and the headline talks about Pogo, the Pogo mine, pouring its very first gold brick at the mine site as they move into production. And that that kind of activity in the state of Alaska is what we're very much interested in achieving with the appropriation bill that is before you today. While I don't think it is fair to say that the appropriations and investments that we've made in mapping the state's resources in the past have led directly to this action or this story appearing in today's paper, I think that the investment that we have made in the past hopefully assures us that over the next few years, with commodity prices being up, that we will be able to steer the private sector investment that flows into our state to make sure that we have headlines like this. And I know, Mr. Chairman, that for the Fairbanks Northstone Borough, there was a study done by Information Insights a number of years ago that indicated that the mining industry or the mining activity that takes place at Fort Knox Mine provides a healthy dose of tax receipts for the borough off the property tax investment and also the largest block of private sector employment, I believe, in the borough. And that's very good for our borough. I think it's a good activity to foster and encourage in any area of the state. The bill that you have before you today proposes that we make an appropriation of $5 million. It is a capital appropriation that would be doled out over a five-year life span, so it would basically, you know, shake out into $1 million a year. And that is in line with a recommendation from the Minerals Commission, which asked for that the level of funding for geophysical surveys be moved up to a level greater than $1 million a year, or at least $1 million a year. So although I asked for the bill to be drafted up and pre-filed with that $1 million in mind, it is roughly at the level that is suggested by the Alaska Minerals Commission. I think if you look at the history, and this is an activity that I have been supportive of and sort of bulldogging over the years, and I asked Mr. Chairman for a funding history of the state general funds going into this geophysical mapping, and what was supplied to me goes back to fiscal year 93, my first year here in the legislature. As an elected individual was fiscal year 94. And at that point, the funding level for this in the capital budget was $750,000. So you know, fairly close to the $1 million. But it has ranged over the years. In fiscal year 06, it went down to $200,000. In fiscal year 2004, which was the year, a very tight year for the legislature, that was the year that the majority bonus payments were discontinued, so gives you an idea to refresh your memory exactly how tight things got that year. We went down to $100,000 a year, so one-tenth of the suggested funding level. And I think you're going to hear from Mr. Robert Swenson with the DGGS that inconsistency in the funding levels has caused some problems with the ability of DNR to sort of map out where they want to map next, how they can combine it with federal funds, how they can have a consistent program and get as big a bang for the state dollar as possible. And this roller coaster of funding that we've had has been somewhat problematic for the agency to deal with. Certainly they'd like to have any dollars possible rather than no dollars, but I think if we can use part of the surplus that we're faced with this year to give them some consistency in funding, I think it bodes well again for continuing development of these headlines that talk about infrastructure, investment in the state, job creation in the state, job creation that is going to have hopefully a predictable life of at least 10 years here in an area of the state that was lacking that degree of capital investment and very good job creation. So with that, I think I will end to see if you've got any particular questions with me. I know Mr. Swenson does have a packet of information that tells you just exactly what the dollars are used for, how the increased degree of detailed information is very useful for, again, to focus that capital investment in the state of Alaska on not only our state-owned land, but other land. But it is, I think, a lot of the investment and focus is on state-owned land so that we, as stewards of the land, have a better idea just exactly what it is that we own out there and how we can, again, focus private capital flowing into the state to get that resource into development for the benefit of the citizens that we represent. So with that, I'm available to answer questions if you have any for me.
Other questions, Senator Ferriott? Senator Stebbins?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I like that concept here going forward and mapping our resources because we are a resource-based state. And there's a presentation up here. Is your plans later on to go through this presentation? I think it's linked with your bill on the geophysical and geological survey information around the state, so the people at home and elsewhere then would get a feel for how much work we've done in the past and then how much work needs to get done?
Yes, Senator Stanton, through the chair. You have officials here with DGGS to walk you through this presentation so that, again, as you said, you, not only the committee members, but for anybody that watches the hearing today, will get a feel for just exactly what it is that we get for the expenditure, why it's important that we get that information, and why it's critically important to the companies, again, that are bringing private sector capital to move from knowing or having an idea where the resource is, but then actually moving it to the point that you're employing Alaskans, making the infrastructure investments so we get the property tax benefit off of that, or payment in lieu of taxes, things of that nature, that benefit the citizens, not only the pocketbook with the paycheck, but support of infrastructure and governmental services.
If I could, Mr. Chairman, one quick follow-up. I was wondering, Senator Terterio, what technology moved forward fairly fast, and some of the work that you mentioned earlier was several years before. Is there a need to go back and update with newer and greater technology some of the old survey information, or are we just off into the new frontiers?
I think, to tell you the truth, the work that has been done over the past couple of years is, perhaps it's not cutting edge, but it's pretty close. I hope that Mr. Swenson will be able to answer your question a little bit more detailed. I know, and I think you might hear today from a company that does satellite imaging, and there is now the ability to perhaps take the the geophysical mapping that we're able to do, you can take that, you can dovetail it with some of the satellite imaging that gives you some topographical features. So it's not necessarily the next layer of technology. It's taking two technological abilities and merging them together. And I think that they would be able to do that, merging that satellite imaging with this aeromag mapping, all the stuff that's been done in the past, and perhaps that can be a component going forward. But again, I would leave that up to the experts to try and get the best information that's of the most critical use to the companies moving forward. So that, again, we get the biggest bang for the buck. Okay. So,
Senator Elton.
Just thanks, Mr. Chair. And Senator Terrio, you can defer this to Mr. Swenson if you want to. I'm just curious as to what, if there are parallel things happening on federal lands that the federal government is doing on BLM lands or Forest Service lands.
Thank you, Senator Elton, to the Chair. The federal government has provided some money, and Mr. Swenson will be able to tell you, give you better information on how the state then has blended the two together so that we can also stretch their limited dollar. It's not to say that we're always on the same sheet on what area needs to be mapped next, but it's my understanding that it's been a pretty good working relationship between the different branches of the federal government and the state effort, again, to make sure that, if we're renting a plane, can we incorporate then share some of that expense, things of that nature, again, to stretch the limited dollar as best as we can.
So they're doing surveys also on federal lands.
Yeah, that's correct, and they're providing federal money to do that.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Further questions, Senator Terrio? There are no more questions. See if there's
go to public hearing. Is there any?
Okay. At this time, we'll go to public hearing in general and ask Robert Swenson to come up and make this presentation. Thank you.
Robert Swenson. I'm the state geologist and acting director of the Division of Geological and Geophysical Surveys. And I have a packet in front of you. It's a PowerPoint presentation. And for the in the interest of time, I know there's a lot going on in the hearing today. I'll probably be going relatively fast through these slides, but please stop me at any point in time if there's any additional information you require.
You can just take your time.
All right. Very good. Thank you. I do like to talk geology.
We like geology.
Yeah. And if I could address the earlier questions just very briefly, I can do that quite quickly. That's okay with the chair. Senator Elton, yes, there is actually a fair amount of work that goes on federal acreage. The differences are sometimes somewhat subtle in the data, the way the data is gathered. We are doing high-res magnetics flying at a 500-foot level with less than half-mile spacing between the flight lines gathering that data. Sometimes it depends on what they're looking for, what specific the geology on the ground they're trying to understand. That will vary on the flight spacing and how they actually acquire that data. And specifically in southwestern Alaska as well as southeast, a lot of those are from fixed-wing rather than helicopter. But they do come to the survey, to the state survey, to contract those programs because we have the system that we have set up to acquire all of that, and they provide us with federal dollars. We actually do the contracting, we acquire the data, we interpret the data, and then turn that over to them, plus publish it through the state. But there is a fair amount of activity on federal acreage. Okay. So if we just go to the first slide here, it's our mission statement, and I won't belabor this point. But Doing the geological geophysical surveys, its mission is to conduct geological and geophysical surveys to determine the potential of Alaskan land for production of metals, minerals, fuels, and geothermal resources. And that's a very important point here, is that we're looking at identifying the potential of that. We don't go out and do our own exploration or anything of that sort, but we do identify for the citizens of Alaska what potential is in Alaska. Also, location and supplies of groundwater construction materials and the potential of geologic hazards to buildings, roads, bridges, and other installations and structures. That's another thing about these geophysical surveys that you'll see here in a moment. The geophysical surveys that we're talking about specifically identify an aspect of geology that allow us, we use that as a tool to go out and do surface mapping. And that's the important point here, is that in and of itself, it's not an end product. It does provide a significant amount of information, specifically where we don't have good exposures, i.e. in tundra-covered areas or like that we can extend the geology that is exposed and move it into areas and get a much better feel for that. And you'll see the examples of that here in just a moment. So if we flip to the next slide, the state of Alaska. This is a digital elevation model of the state of Alaska, and there's lots and lots of colors on here. And I'll just point to two of them. One is the all the red that you see that seems to be focused in a lot of the mountainous areas. And what that represents are anomalously high mineral occurrences on the sample database that we currently have. And as what you can see here, there's a tremendous diversity in the location of all these different mineral samples and the anomalously high rate. That doesn't mean that all of these different areas have the ability to have a mine by any stretch of the imagination. It just shows that in these areas where we have very little understanding of the local geology, there is an anomalously high mineral occurrence of all different types. Another thing on this diagram is this rectangle that you see in the central part of the state. And what that is it represents the state of Colorado, the square miles of the state of Colorado. It just gives us a scale of reference of what we're dealing with in Alaska as far as the diversity and the aerial extent of this mineralization that we have. And then finally, the small blue boxes that you see represent the various surveys that we have flowing since 1993, as Senator Terry had referred to. In these areas, we have the high-resolution magnetics and resistivity flowing, and we've also followed up with the surface mapping associated with that. And the point being by this diagram is that there is a significant amount of area to see yet to be covered. This represents about 6 million acres of the 40 million acres that have been identified as high potential mineral areas. So if we flip to the next slide here, the statistics on the mineral program. First bullet here is that $1.7 million of federal matching funds for geologic mapping has been brought into the state and used at the survey for surface mapping. So we pulled in with a matching fund program of $1.7 million. That's just specifically from the mineral section within the division. As I said, 6.1 million acres of high-resolution geophysics through the state funding, and 3.7 million acres through BLM funding, which has been flown on federal acres throughout the state. There are currently 40 million acres identified as high potential, and of course that varies greatly depending on what the different ones that you are looking at. Currently, the cost of flying geophysics is around $575 per square mile. Now, that varies greatly. It's varied from $350 all the way up to $750, and this becomes one of the key points for this bill, and that is our ability to negotiate with the contractors flying this data in a long-term contract rather than year-to-year, and there's a graph that I'll show in just a moment that addresses that. And finally, there's 3 million acres, and this is the important part about this. In and of itself and by itself, the geophysics provides very good information, but it's not the end product. The end product is a geologic map that we've gone out and done interpretations and essentially calibrated what the surface rock, what the rock is at the ground with the response that the geophysics has given you. And that's a very, very important point. Without the surface work, the geophysics can be interpreted in a number of different ways. And that's where we use a lot of the federal dollars and state matching fund to get out on the ground and do that surface mapping. And I've got a couple of examples here in just a minute. So the next slide, how does it benefit the state? One of the key ones, of course, is it just provides us with a much better assessment of the state's resource base. Whether that turns into a mine in the future or not, then that goes through the entire public process to do that. But it certainly is important that we understand what we have in the state as far as resources so we can do better planning. It also keeps, and this is another important point, it keeps this high-resolution data in the public realm. If the companies were to go out and fly one of these surveys, which they do, usually that stays in proprietary nature. We do not get to see the data, so any company that comes to the state of Alaska wanting to enter and look at the exploration potential will not have access to that data in a proprietary sense. So the fact that we get that out in the public realm makes it is very important for new companies that are entering. It also is vital for prioritization of land selection and transfer. It was incredibly important in during that land selection process, and as well as it currently is in our reprioritization of those lands as we gain additional data. And it truly is a stepping-off point for explorers. We're not out there doing the actual exploring and finding mines. That's not our job. Our job is to understand how to provide a set of baseline data where they can go in, any companies, if they so choose, in an exploration sense, go out and start in on a very, very detailed analysis of a given area. And then finally, it's very critical data for infrastructure and community planners, and that will come clear here when we talked about the pipeline corridor that was just recently flown. So if we move to the next slide, one of the things is we don't want to make it, and this actually addresses Senator Stedman's earlier comment, that there is a lot of data out there already. The entire state actually has had some form of geophysics flown over it. However, it's very, very regional in sense, very, very wide spacing. And what this next series of slides shows you is what we're taking it to that next level. We're taking it to a point where we actually can start seeing things on the ground. So if you take between the slide that's up right now and flip back and forth, and I'm sorry we don't have the PowerPoint up, but just go back and forth between those two, you'll see within that white polygon what it means to go from regional data to high-resolution data. And so you can see a dramatic difference in what's seen at the surface there. And that's an important point, and when we start delineating surface work, when we're out there on the ground, that we can see this level of resolution so we can provide a much better job of surface geologic mapping. Okay, and if you move to the next couple, three slides here, this just talks to the regional, again, the next few slides are all about on this A2 quadrangle, and you can see the scale bar down there is about 5 miles, the small bar, and it just shows the difference between the regional data and the local data, and we'll step through these slides all the way to the final product of a geologic map, that geologic map looked like before and what it looks like today. And so you can see the regional versus the detailed. The next one actually shows the two different types of geophysics that we acquired during our flight, and that includes resistivity and the aeromagnetics. And you can see these are both exactly the same areas, and we're looking at very, very different responses to the rock, to that geophysical parameter. And so we can use both of these to help us understand what is in the subsurface in a given area. And then finally, if you look at the next page, you can see the original map of this area, of the A2 quadrangle. And then after we flown the geophysics, went back out and redid the mapping, you can see the detail associated with that. So it's a dramatic difference, and this is across the board in any of these areas that we go to. At the bottom of the page, you'll see two different boxes. One is the Fort Knox footprint, the other is the Pogo footprint. And the interesting thing is that if you took either one of those boxes, put them in the old regional mapping, it would easily fit within an area that shows no definition whatsoever. However, in the detailed mapping, you'd have a hard time fitting that into an area without at least it showing up on your survey. Okay, so if you move to the next page now, this is in the interior Alaska. This is not the only areas that have released this data, but this shows historic data plus the red polygons here are actually where just recently at Dead Web Cuver, just last month, we released an additional, the last phase of data that we had acquired. And it shows just some of the general aspects within that. But you can also see some of the current operating mine in the areas. And there's certainly been a lot of staking going on post the release of this data. The next slide shows a fairly major survey that was just finished here just about, I think, 3 weeks ago now. And this was from Delta Junction to the Canadian border. There's a slight difference in our acquisition parameters, but the focus of this survey, the geophysical survey here, was to look at geohazards along the proposed pipeline corridor, and that includes any faulting, any major structures that could possibly have been hazardous to a pipeline in this area, as well as a bedrock mapping and surface resources, gravel and whatnot, for construction process possibilities. Next page shows some of the companies that immediately upon release of this latest survey bought this data. Just gives you an idea of who's interested in Alaska. The next slide shows a map of the state with the 2004-2005 expiration that's going on in the state, and you can see it's a very, very busy map. Lots of expiration going on. The blue background is all the state acreage, of course. And then the next slide shows some acreage, and this is a very important slide, acreage of new mining claims that are staked per year. And you can see as we get additional data in areas and release that data, we're seeing a dramatic increase in this. And the proceeds from this nearly cover the cost of the program to date. And then the next slide, historic funding for the program, and Senator Terrio addressed this earlier, but this puts it in a graphical sense. You can see there's a high variability over the last, since 1993, we've gone back to the legislature for CIP requests and for funding for this program, and you can see there's a lot of variability, and what this bill will do for us is two things. It will allow us to go in a long-term contract and save money associated with that negotiation of a long-term contract. And it will also help us increase the amount of acres that we can cover because of those savings, and those are two of the most important parts of that. You see a large spike in 2005, and what that's associated with is that the pipeline corridor and the gas line supplemental that we flew the geophysics along from Delta to the Canadian border. And so the final slide here just outlines the benefits, or some of the benefits of a stable funding source for this program. Our ability to negotiate a long-term contract and the cost savings associated with that. Cost savings associated with the mobilization and demobilization of the equipment needed on a year-by-year basis. Increased coverage over geophysics and high-resolution geologic mapping on state land, and most importantly, our understanding as policymakers, the understanding of what we have in the state as a resource base. And I will answer any questions that you may have.
Real quickly, I mean, you talked about cost recovery, and I'm assuming that you're talking about cost recovery through purchase of the data and through staking, and I'd be interested in how much you sell the data for and how much you recover on staking.
The data is actually very, very cheap. We wanted to make sure, and we do make sure, that it's available to everyone in the public, and so now we've updated our website to where you can actually download that data. You can come in and purchase it in a CD, but it's the proceeds associated with that are very limited. We want to make sure that it's available across the board and not just to specific entities. And as far as the cost recovery goes, we don't have a specific program set up to recover the cost of the flight. What we're seeing is that increased activity from claiming and the monies associated with that, and if a mine is found, and there's been lots and lots of hearings on the Hill here just recently outlining a lot of those, and I don't have that bill in front of me, so I can't address that specifically, but in that sense, that's how that cost recovery happens. Mm-hmm.
Further questions? See you then. Thank you very much for the presentation.
Thank you.
Well, with that, we're going to close public hearing, and this is the pleasure of the committee.
There is one gentleman from ETERRA.
I didn't register him.
Oh, he didn't register, so go ahead and come forward, though.
Thank you. I'll be brief. My name is Steve Culligan, president of a satellite mapping company called ETERRA out of Anchorage. Been in Alaska my entire life, lived through plenty of ups and downs in the economy as a mapper for the last 22 years. Business isn't necessarily into geophysical mapping, but I have been involved in the periphery of providing other mapping information that this layer of information is provided over the top of. My general sense, I think you heard simply that to provide a decent program, Mr. Terrio said stability, a program moving forward. There's been lots of talk about Alaska developing its resources, and I think it's very important that we understand what resources we have if we're actually going to develop them. DGGS has a proven track record of having the access to this funding, providing some very useful data that has turned into some successful developments. In general, we keep talking about data. As a mapper, it used to be we drew things by hand. Everything is computer generated. And the information, vast amounts of information processing needs to take place. Information from a satellite gets compiled and registered, and the accuracy of that information, the technology's changed. It's very efficient, but that information is processed, and it needs some stability and to be part of a regular program, whether large or small, so that we can move forward. The state as a whole, when it comes to mapping, is in pretty poor shape. As a Boy Scout in Fairbanks 30-some years ago, we still have the same maps, the same inaccurate maps that I used 35 years ago. As a business person, it's been my driver, but I can't ignore the fact that traditional mapping for Homeland Security and other development is all about avoided cost, and the new mappers are people who go out and need data when they step out the door for Homeland Security to go find things, to go rescue somebody, et cetera, rather than information for a particular project. They assume that information is there when they step out the door. In the same regard, this geological mapping has a very high return on investment, and it's just an analogy. I could call myself a rancher because I own some land, but I don't know whether I have 1,500 chickens or I have 1,500 cows. The state's in the same position. What resources do you have? What's your plan for developing and coming up with a stable program to inventory those and generate business within the state? I think it was a brief question about a return on investment. The return on investment, I think, has been fairly clear and consistent. When that funding has been available, there has been more activity, there has been more business interest, there has been more field work done by private companies on their own nickel to go research, take the information provided, and get their own information, their own analysis, and provide private investment to develop those resources. That's all I have. Thank you.
Question. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Senator Terry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Before you close out today, I think you've heard good information. One of the other things I just wanted to mention to the committee is I understand that this is an appropriation bill. It's very unusual for a separate appropriation bill on a line item to make its way through the process. But absent submitting a separate appropriation bill to get the issue before your committee, then the Finance Committee just considers capital requests upstairs. I'm hoping that your committee will feel comfortable with passing the bill, and your individual recommendations will go up to them, and I'm hoping that Senator Stedman will take the excitement of the Resources Committee up and express them to the co-chair in charge of the capital budget. I think we have an interesting opportunity at the time when the commodity prices are high, and you can't tell exactly in the future when that might come down. I think if the state indicates that we believe in the state's mineral potential, and we can attract a lot of that investment. You know that once the companies make the infrastructure investment, they will ride the roller coaster of the commodity price up and down and continue that investment, continue the jobs and the paychecks that are spun off of that. And I think we should strike while the iron is hot, strike while the commodity prices are high, indicate to the companies that we're willing to put in a buck to help inventory what we think we've got here in the state to attract that private sector investment. Thank you.
Senator Terrio.
Senator.
Before the Senator goes, first, thanks. I mean, you've been focused on this for a long time, and I appreciate the focus that you brought to the issue, that you make the rest of us bring to the issue. Just a real quick question, I mean, as it does go to finance. I mean, the assumption I'm making from reading the language is $5 million over 5 years, so about $1 million a year. There's nothing that stops $2.5 million 1 year and $2.5 million the next year. And I'm just wondering about, you know, your thoughts as you did build this way. I mean, one of the things that I find compelling about this approach is that in fact it allows the department to maybe make a contract with a vendor that provides air support for 5 years rather than on a basis. So there are efficiencies of just knowing that the money is out there ahead. But what are the what is the likelihood they'll go $2.5 million the first year and $2.5 million the second?
Well, Mr. Senator, they certainly would have the latitude to do that, and I like to give the agencies some flexibility. They may have determined that in conjunction with some work the federal government wants, that more than $1 million, that number one, they can get it out, do it at a very good price, and so perhaps 1 year they want to exceed the $1 million. I think, however, that you've heard that the department is not interested in seeing, you know, sharp swings up and down, so they wouldn't want, I don't believe, $2 million the first year, nothing the next year, then $1 million and $500,000, because you're not able to plan and get enter into contracts to get stretch your dollar. So whether they would get to expending it all before 5 years is out, I guess I'll leave that up to the agency to, again, get good utilization of the state dollar.
Thanks. Additional
thank you,
Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
With that, I'm going to close public hearing, the public hearing, and what is the pleasure of the committee?
I'd like a motion to move.
Please.
I'd like to go ahead and make a motion that we move Senate Bill 213 Version A out of committee with individual recommendations, and does not have an attached fiscal note. I'm sure the next committee will deal with that. Clearly noted here at $5 million.
Is there any objection? The next item before the committee today is HB 37, Public Access to Fishing Streams. This bill has previously been heard. We didn't get time to do any public testimony on this bill. So at this time, I'd like to go to public hearing. Does anybody want to? There's nobody online for public hearings. Is there anybody in general wish to be heard on this bill? Sponsor, nobody's interested in your bill.
Mr. Chair, quite a few people testified at the first hearing, but in truth, when they offered, there were two people who were going to be online, but one couldn't make it, and I don't know what happened to the other.
Okay. I'd like to have the bill sponsor come up. I've got a couple of questions.
Sure.
Appreciate you not having me, Bill. my main concern is it depends on the type of access we provide and how much access we provide. You know, we've been spending a lot of money, and I shouldn't say we because it isn't the state of Alaska, but certain groups have been spending a lot of money repairing damaged stream banks that are done by individual fishermen wanting access, no restriction on access to that stream. And I know of two, maybe three places on the Kenai River that are basically permanently closed to foot traffic on the river because of the degradation that is caused on the stream banks. And you know, the riparian area is very important.
for the fish smoke, for the health and the vitality of the stream. So maybe you want to address that a little bit. That's a major concern to me. I'm not sure the bill doesn't go overboard on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's a very important concern. I know the sections of the Kenai River, some of them that you're talking about, right below the bridge going through Soldotna, for example. It's two separate issues. The Department of Fish and Game and Natural Resources both have the power to limit public access if habitat damage is being caused, if riparian damage is being caused. So just because land is public and is accessible doesn't mean that the Department of Fish and Game or Natural Resources can't rope off a whole section of river for habitat reasons. And we could put that in the bill to make it clear that nothing in this bill should impact the state's ability to protect an area for habitat or the riparian reasons you mentioned. This bill certainly doesn't intend to say the public always has to have access regardless of whether they're causing damage to a riverbank. One of the first fisheries issues I ever got involved in was on the Upper Kenai River, where the government tried to limit public access on a long stretch of river. And we came up with a system where they roped off the areas that were being damaged, the soft grassy bank areas, but not the large area where people were fishing gravel bars, where they weren't causing damage. And that's the difference. Sometimes on a high bank, you have to walk a soft area so you can get to a gravel bar. And sometimes in the worst case, there are some snagging holes where people just sit on the grassy banks and they cause a lot of damage, or even just fishing holes where they cause a lot of damage. If that were happening, the state should be able to close them off to protect them. And I don't think you have to state anything in this bill because the state has that power. Both Department of Fish and Game and Natural Resources have that power. But we could emphasize it in this bill to make sure that they could protect against damage.
Thank you, Representative. Any questions this time, Representative? Okay, thank you very much. I'm going to ask Sarah, are you online? You on there, Sarah?
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes. Did you hear what Representative Garrett just said to the police?
Yes. For the record, this is Sarah Gilbert, Special Assistant to the Commissioner Gill at the Department of Fish and Game. And I did get a call this afternoon from Representative Garrett's office asking about exactly this issue. And while I couldn't find anything in statute, what I learned is that Fish and Game, in maintaining access, tries to do so in a habitat-friendly manner. And specifically looking at Cook Inlet and the Kenai, our ability there to regulate access and to make sure that it is habitat-friendly is under the Upper Cook Inlet Management Plan. And I don't think that we have similar plans that allow similar actions all around. So that's what I learned.
Senator, a follow-up question, Sarah, to the chair's question. I mean, I guess I had assumed that with the provisions of this bill, that the Department of Fish and Game would be identifying areas to seek to find, you know, a common ground on providing access, so a willing buyer and a willing seller. And I guess I had assumed that process would include a decision prior to making any kind of an offer on access, on whether or not habitat degradation would occur if, in fact, that happened. And I guess I would assume that any place where you thought there would be habitat degradation, you wouldn't prioritize that as an area needing access, and that you'd focus on areas in which degradation is less likely to occur. Is that correct?
Senator, for the chair, this is Sarah Gilbertson. We might want to ask the bill sponsor. I'm just pulling out the bill again and looking at the language. But if I might just suggest that if the committee is concerned about the habitat, that we make sure that there's language in the bill that specifies when Fish and Game or DNR are putting together these lists and making these trades or acquiring this land, that we do so with that in mind.
hearing the respondent.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I misspoke before. My understanding of the way it works is, since the landowner is the Department of Natural Resources, they would, in consultation with the Department of Fish and Game, decide what areas need to be protected. But I think the statute that we were given by the Department of Natural Resources, their power to regulate access and habitat protection is 3805035. But I think actually Ms. Gilbertson is correct. We should make a clarification in the bill to make clear that nothing in the bill would prevent the state from protecting the kinds of things you mentioned.
Okay. Any other questions from the sponsor, Senator Stedman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm still not very comfortable with this bill. And, you know, this is an example of page 2, line 4. You know, it talks about the land ownership, you know, prevents private land ownership prevents public access to a section of waterway that is highly desirable for its fishing or other recreational attributes. And language like or other recreational attributes to me is pretty broad, and I'm concerned about potential abuses or that could come from this particular bill. And there is also other entities out there, private entities that purchase property, you know, to turn it back into the public domain. And I just am rather reluctant to see the state go into that particular business. I'd like to see more property privatized, and less property owned by the state, and more federal land owned by the state.
I don't think we're going to get more federal land.
Well, I understand that, but I understand that. I understand that.
And the other thing, Representative Garrett, the state does have, if they determine that there is not enough public access to an area, they do have the right of eminent domain, and they can gain that access if they really want to gain that access. I'm having a tough time taking land, for instance, out of the private hand, putting it in the public hand, taking it off the tax rolls. I told you that before. And that's my hang up on this bill. And that does lend itself to that inevitability. That's the problem I have right now. Further questions of Representative Garrett? Thank you, Representative.
Can I respond to the last comment?
Sure.
On the tax rolls issue, I understand that too. And so on an overall basis, I certainly understand the need to get more land into private hands. But just because you're trying to get more land into private hands doesn't mean that we shouldn't do something to protect public access along fishing streams. And what we're trying to do is have the state look at areas that really aren't doing very much for the tax rolls. And if you look at page 2, line 16, we want them to focus on undeveloped lands, in large part because those are the ones the state could afford to get an easement on. If you wait till they're developed, it's too late. And for example, in Montana, they can barely buy any land back. It's just too expensive because they waited too long. So really, as far as the tax rolls go, you buy an easement along some undeveloped land, you've enhanced the value of the property in the neighborhood because now everybody can fish, and you've taken very little off the tax rolls because it's largely undeveloped that we could afford to get in the first place. And we're telling the state, you have very limited money. We don't want you to go prioritizing by spending your money on developed lands. Montana Creek, a lot of the creeks on the road system right now, where we're going to lose access, it's the undeveloped lands that are private and that we'd like to get an easement along or property rights along so the public has access in the future.
Senator Dyson.
I misheard. Did you say that the easement will increase the property value?
The easement not the property value on where the easement is. Arguably it could, but doubtfully. But it would, if you have, for example, a row of undeveloped land along Montana Creek, for example, 5 miles of private land, the property owners across the street and in the succeeding streets, the value of their land will go up because they'll have public access all along the stream.
Right.
Yeah. So on the whole, but not the particular property, right?
They did misunderstand, right?
I think so, yeah.
But I don't know. I guess it's all in the eye of the beholder. If I had a piece of land, I'm not necessarily the type of individual that want public access across the face of my land. Because I've been in a situation. I don't want people staring in my living room window or my bedroom window or anything else. So that's, we got to wait.
When the state then offers you money, you would say no, and then it would be over. And they would never get the public access on your land. So the bill is completely voluntary. It says the state should identify the highest importance areas and come up with a list of those areas. And the moment a private property owner says, don't bug me, I'm not selling it to you, the state goes on its merry way.
That's right. But if we allow an access, an easement, like you do in Hawaii to the beach, you know, you will find people really don't like to be along that easement because of the, you know, I mean, I've been on this easement. Litter, garbage, and a lot of hotels try to be very restrictive as to where those people that use that to get to the beach, how far up or down the beach they can go. That's a private property issue versus public access right there. But it's what I'm talking about is somebody's got an easement over here. And my piece of property is across the river. Just because I don't want to give them an easement across the front of my property, that isn't going to stop people from trespassing. That isn't going to stop people from wading across the stream and going up and down the river. Because they're going to do that automatically. They got the right to do that. And I just guess it's allowing more and more access. I'm not sure the state needs to go in situation where they're providing access. Kenai River, I think, is over access now. We're killing the Kenai River. We're loaded to death. And I just don't want to see that happen to some of these other schools. That's my argument with that and taking land off the tax. And maybe with the easement, it wouldn't be so much taking it off the tax rolls. But I can see some places where the only way the state can get easements, instead of an easement being granted, they would have a purchased property, and that's where that would come in.
Mr. Chair, can I respond to that? We're asking the state to use this in a very small range of circumstances. We're asking them to identify about 2 linear miles of riverbank, and I bet you it would take 10 or 15 or 20 years for the state to ever buy through that 2 miles. So out of over 100,000 miles of river area, we're talking about a very limited area of the most important areas to fishermen, and we've identified 3 of them, which are Montana Creek, the Anchor River, the Salcher River, very high-use fisheries that aren't being damaged right now. And so we're really not asking them to go look, and we say they should be undeveloped areas because they're cheaper to get. So we're not telling them to go into subdivisions and start buying back property from property owners where there would be this conflict. We're saying in the future, before the property is built, let's figure out which areas the public cherishes for fishing purposes. And there are some that we would like to get in the public domain. That's why all of the major sport fishing groups in the state support the bill. But it's limited. It doesn't say go buy back 100 miles of land. It says identify a list of 2 miles, and you know, maybe in 20 years we'll have bought back 4 miles or 5 miles in the most highly important areas.
And part of the currently problems with access to those systems?
They're developing. On Montana Creek, people are starting to put up no trespassing signs even on property they don't own. Because really, as a neighborhood property owner, you have this instinct that you want the river to be yours. But if every property owner does that, then the public at large won't be able to fish the streams. You can't just float through a lot of these smaller rivers. You have to stop, and if there's no place to stop, or if there's no place to walk along the gravel bars and access the gravel bars, those streams are gone. We're not talking about the Kenai River, and I would frankly even exempt the Kenai River from this bill. That's not the intention at all. The Kenai River, the whole upper section of the Kenai River is open. Large sections of the lower Kenai River are open. And in the places where they're not open, people have built houses. You don't want to start having people traipse across somebody's house. So those aren't the kinds of areas we're focusing on.
Senator, several times during the testimony here and in the preceding testimony to the meetings, Montana Creek, Willow Creek, were mentioned, along Anchor Point, Deep Creek, and so on and so forth. But in the language of the bill, the preceding paragraph on page 3, line 26, refers to this as the initial list. That's to be submitted to the Commissioner of Natural Resources before July 1st. And I think we have a potential here of abuse in this. So that's just the initial list. And the way this is worded, they can virtually include any stream in the state with fish in it. And most of the streams and rivers I'm familiar with have fish in them. So, I mean, it's pretty wide open.
Through the chair. Senator Stedman, I believe the bill is actually intended to do the exact opposite. Right now, the state has the ability to do eminent domain over any piece of property anywhere in the state. They can buy back unimportant streams, develop streams where people have houses. What this bill says is prioritize. So we're trying to focus the state to come up with a small list of lands. Even though that we could buy back all 100,000 plus miles of riverbank today, we're saying no, just focus on the areas that are most important to public access and a public fishery so that we don't make the mistake the lower 49 states have made, which is giving away our public access so now only rich people can fish. So the intent is to do the exact opposite. It's to say focus on the most important areas. Don't spend your time thinking about the least important areas and stay away from the developed properties that are frankly way too expensive for us to be spending state money on.
That's true. I just don't see that language in the bill. I hear it in the meeting, but when I read the bill, I don't see that language in the bill. I see a real open-ended issue where, depending on, you know, who, or the attitude of the people that compile this list, what they may or may not include in the future. Clearly, the initial list includes these creeks that you feel are critical, Montana Creek and Willow Creek, but this bill goes far beyond that.
Through the chair. The bill asks the state to identify up to 2 miles worth, just three of those creeks, and the Anchor River, Montana Creek, and the Salcha. The sections that people fish right now, there's over 7 miles of private land that the state would probably never even get through in the next 10 years. So, and then the parts of the bill that say, don't just willy-nilly go buy any piece of property out there are on page 2, where it says on line 18, the state should only look at the places with quote-unquote the greatest potential for public recreational and subsistence use. And then on page line 16, focus on the undeveloped lands. The intention, again, was because those are affordable, but the side benefit is you're also not buying back people's homes and you're not buying back people's recreational properties where they've already made this vested interest to develop a piece of land. So those are the protection zone.
If I could, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Stedman.
Just like on page 3, line 13, this is, you know, the plan must include a minimum access of not less than a total of 2 meander miles. Am I reading that wrong? I infer that as meaning at least, but it could be greater than. But listening to the testimony, it sounds the opposite, up to. So I'm kind of confused.
Through the chair. Yeah, I certainly didn't mean up to. I meant 2 miles. I have every belief that if we say at least 2 miles, the state's not going to identify more than 2 miles. It's expensive for them to survey. There's going to be a little bit of resistance among in-state government to spend the money to identify a 100-mile list of lands when they know they don't have the money even to buy the first 2 miles. So I think it's going to be in effect 2 miles, but if you want to put a cap and say no more than, a certain amount, then that would be completely reasonable too. But when I say a minimum of two, I have every expectation they're not going to identify much more than two.
I can understand, to kind of both sides of the equation, and so a comment from the sponsor committee and the sponsor that we want. It seems to me that, you've got, if you want to preserve access for people that can't afford to buy, creekside or lakeside property, I guess I envisioned that this process would be a much more of a kind of a community-based process where local fisheries fish and game advisory committees would say, I don't think they can say, this clam beach, may be closed off, but that they could say, we're having more and more problems at our Montana Creek. I don't know how many Montana Creeks there are, but and so the Juneau Fish and Game Advisory Board could say, let's talk to the department about, how we can preserve access in a way that works for the people that may live fairly close to the creek. And so I saw it more as an intuitive process rather than a process that's completely controlled by a recipe, because, what works on my Montana Creek may not work for your Montana Creek. And I guess I'm just trusting that in that kind of a process that you end up with avoiding the big battles with a neighborhood association, for example, because you're not going to move too far ahead, and you would focus on something where you could maybe provide access before it gets built up. Not a question, but you may want to respond, because I do understand the property rights versus public access, but it just seems to me that the problem that we're trying to fix here before it becomes a problem is just ensuring that there is access, so that as that land gets developed, people know that that access is there and they can make their plans accordingly.
Sure, through the chair. You do want the public to be involved, and then Bill provides for public comment in this, and we do envision that it would be groups like the Fishing and Advisory Committees and things like that that say, here's an area my kid and I have been fishing for 20 years. We want to make sure that there's access 20 years from now. Just related to that and a point made before, the reason you want the state to identify these areas is I think we have more faith in the Department of Fish and Game to say what's important to the public than we do in a private environmental group. And right now, the process is the only lands we're buying back are the ones that resource groups have identified for purchase. And I think it's more responsible for the state through the Department of Fish and Game to say what's important than it is for private entities to be in control of that process. And I think a side benefit is once we start identifying these areas, it may be that private money goes at them, and we focus the private money where it should be focused.
Further comments? Okay, I'm going to hold this another series here. I'm going to get with the sponsor and talk to him about a few of these things that have been brought up. So with that, we'll go on to the next bill then. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
We'll go on to the next bill. That's the SB 203.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator.
That's all right. I'll talk to you.
SB 203 Unified Permit Application. Senator Guest.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Gretchen Guest, State Senator from District J. In front of you is SB 203. The purpose of SB 203 is for the state to create a one-stop online permitting system to hopefully create a more efficient system both for the state and those trying to develop our resources. You'll see in the bill that it has two phases. One is actually creating a unified permit system, and we envision, I guess since it's tax time, it's easiest to think about that, but we envision a system where you would if you need to go to this schedule, you go get that piece of paper, and this schedule, you go get that piece of paper, to try to create one system that everyone can go to for their permitting needs versus having to go to every single department and get their pieces of paper to fill out. And it would be a unified permit for any time you have a project with two or more agencies. And that's how it's defined in the bill currently. The second phase would put that system online. It would allow someone to apply online and then that data to automatically go into databases in the departments and be able to be updated online. Hopefully create some efficiencies on the state side and a little bit more streamlined process. In an initial version of the bill, not one that we got introduced, but when we went out for stakeholder comments, we had excluded de minimis projects, and that's the language we used. Legal didn't really like that language, so on page 9 of the bill at the top, you'll see this permitting system would not apply. And we try to, you know, all those small little permits, we're not trying to do that. We're trying to look at larger developments where people actually have to go to multiple agencies on multiple pieces of paper and try to find one system. We also cast the net fairly wide to then try to get stakeholder issues and concerns to then reduce the bill to an appropriate level. I have given the Natural Resource Aid an amendment that Fish and Game was nice enough to create or to bring to our attention, which actually removes sections 1 through 4 of the bill. Sections 1 through 3, it was pointed out to us, don't need to be there. And section 4, which is saying that the entry into Alaska commercial fishing would be regulated by this, we were convinced wasn't the purpose of the bill and now goes to that list on page 9. And that was at the recommendations of Fish and Game. So with that, I'll answer any questions about the bill, and I believe DNR was online to make some comments as well.
Are there questions of the bill sponsor?
Apparently
there's some testimony online that moved too much.
Senator, there are department people to respond to the questions.
Oh, they're not testified.
So there are no questions online. Apparently there's people testifying.
Amendment by Senator Guest.
Do you need somebody to move the amendment, Mr. Chair?
Well, I want to move that, please. This is the amendment she just covered in her testimony. Is there a motion on the amendment?
I'd like to go ahead and move the amendment number one.
Any discussion on the amendment? Is there an objection to the amendment? Seeing none, it's adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe we can have the bill sponsor, Senator Guest, talk a little bit about the bill and the potential implications of all the different departments working together. Are they all in unison and going forward, thinking that this is going to work, or will it be the old turf battle issue that we're going to have to deal with?
Through the chair, Senator Spitz, and I think you have people online that you might want to put that question to. It's my hope that if this bill became law, that there wouldn't be those turf battles. I do think people are going to have to come together and work pretty hard at where do we have common elements, where do we have elements that are really asking for the same thing, but we might call them something different, and really work to create one application system. So I don't pretend to say that this bill is going to be necessarily easy on the departments, nor the online section inexpensive, but I do believe it's important. I think we all often talk about Alaska being open for business, and I think this is a step in that direction. We should make the permitting system, we want the focus of the permitting system on being able to write the correct permit for the area, not trying to get someone through the hurdles of paperwork. So I would hope that the departments would work together. I think from what I've been told by DNR, there are a couple projects that they have done, a couple specific instances that they've worked on this. And it seems, at least for those projects, we're being told to have worked. But I will admit that it won't be easy and it won't be done overnight. That's why you have two phases, and each phase is given a year.
Further question. Dick Miles, you hear me, Dick?
Yes, sir. Dick Miles at Parkland Resources.
Okay. What is your take on this bill?
Senator, actually, Randy Bates should be there for DNR. He's actually our spokesperson. I'm here just to answer questions to back up.
All right. At this time, we'll go to public hearings here in Juneau. Randy?
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Randy Bates. I'm the acting director of the Office of Project Management and Permitting, which is within the Department of Natural Resources. I do appreciate the opportunity to come speak with you about this bill. I am here to represent the three resource agencies that whose permits are within this bill, who are called out the permits specifically. That is Fishing Game, Natural Resources, and Environmental Conservation. This administration is very supportive of the concept of permit streamlining. In fact, this administration, with support from the legislature, has initiated, completed, and realized some very important programmatic and permit process streamlining reforms. However, the administration and its resource agencies do not support Senate Bill 203. There are three basic reasons why we don't offer that support. First, the unified permit application concept fails for practical reasons that is proposed in Senate Bill 203. The second reason is, to the extent we can streamline and simplify the application with permit application process, we are doing that. The third reason is, there is significant financial support that would be needed to implement this bill. With that, I'll certainly make myself available at this time or any time outside the committee as you see fit.
Thank you, Randy. Question, Senator Ellis?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Randy, I'm curious. I understand kind of some of the institutional and procedural kinds of issues that could come up, but what about the second part? What about the part that provides that people can apply for permits online? It seems to me that in a digital age, that just makes sense.
In the chair, Senator Elton, certainly that makes sense, and I think within DNR and the other resource agencies, particularly DEC, we are moving towards online permit applications. DEC has much of their air permit program online, so that not only can the applicant apply online, but they can also report and share information between that agency. DNR particularly is also working on two different initiatives. One of them is related to the coastal management program, and that's the online development of a coastal project questionnaire. What that initiative is making an interactive, fillable form that is online, such that an applicant can fill in that information and submit that form to the coordinating applicant, both the project management permitting in this case. DNR is also, again, through the support of the legislature, working on a project questionnaire for an online application permit specific to two of our agencies within DNR, and that would be the Coastal Management Program within OPMP, as well as Mining, Land, and Water. And that's about a four-year project at the cost of a little over $4 million to create, again, a fillable form or a fillable application that is interactive with the applicant.
If I could just follow up. So, and Randy, I apologize if I'm misinterpreting what you just said, but it just seems to me that especially the language that begins on page 6 that talks about permit application information on the Internet, it just seems to me that what you've just said is accomplished here, but you talked about a four-year deadline, and this talks about things that need to be done within a year. So you don't disagree with where this section of the bill is going. Do you just disagree with the deadlines?
Well, again, the concept of creating a fillable or online application is a worthy goal. I think that's a very good prospect or concept. The problem becomes when you take a look at the type of application, the very real situation when an applicant an industry organization from filling out 30 or 40 different applications to create a paper version of that in one form is just simply a bit overwhelming and certainly would be difficult to accomplish within the time frame spelled out in this bill, which is 1 year.
Mr. Chair, just a comment. Randy, feel free to respond if you want. I mean, I think that's the nub of what we're trying to get to in this bill, is that there might be 30 or 40 applications, and it's all done by paper. And so it seems to me that, you know, if nothing else, a good first step is, let's say, get it done. If you can't get it done in that amount of time, then come back. But it just seems to me that we're in the digital age now, and at least the component that is the Internet component of this seems to be real important. And it also sounds like it might happen faster if we tell them it needs to be done.
Further questions of Ren? Thank you, Mr. Meadows. I'd just like to state that I did have a discussion with the mining Association, and they're real hesitant about this. Because the process is working now, just like Randy said, and they are having very little problem with the process. They're getting their permits, they're getting them in what they think is a timely fashion, and they said the last thing they want to see is something to disrupt the process that they're used to, and I guess it's a matter of being familiar. It's kind of like when I went to a workshop earlier this summer, the Mega Projects workshop. They said, you know, new technology may not be the best thing to use in a mega project because you want to use proven technology. And I'm not saying that about the doing the permit online. That may be where we wind up. But as far as the process they have in place right now, they say they're very comfortable with the permitting process. They said we've done a lot to revise it and to bring it up the last 3 or 4 years, and they would like to have it stay in place the way it is for a while. So that was the input of the director of the Alaska Mining Association, the Miners Association. Senator Guest.
Mr. Chair, in response, there is a letter from the Miners Association in there, and I think they have different concerns, as you just stated. I have a few responses for the committee to consider. Just being one industry or one group of people that are in Alaska right now and who are familiar with the process doesn't necessarily mean the process is the best that we can make it in the state. especially when we're trying to get new entrants into the market. I would agree that we have to be concerned that we don't disrupt the current process as we create a new one. But I wanted to make clear for the record that it's not changing the permit process at all. What it's changing is the application process. So I don't want people to think that permits are going to be written differently or any of the current system. That's not what this bill is trying to do. And I know that that wasn't your intent, Mr. Chair, but I've gotten a couple questions worried about changing the permit process. This is just changing the application process and how one updates data. We have asked DNR for any suggested changes that they would like to see on concerns that they have. We haven't received any at this time. We received those from Fish and Game. I will try to respect the different jurisdictions of the different committees, but I did want to make one note about the fiscal impacts, and we haven't gotten a fiscal note yet, but I'm sure one is coming, and I expect one. I'm not going to question spending $4 million on creating one unified application permit, nor how much this whole thing may cost, but if at least it's this administration's focus to do it now if we can, honestly seems like a fairly inefficient system. Why would you create one unified application for this system over here at a certain amount of money and then create another one over here for another system? Although it might be more in total, it would seem as if it would be a more efficient system to actually create a unified online system, and if there's some things that people don't use it for, that's okay. This project doesn't say that you can't use the paper system, but it seems as if we're going to piecemeal unified permitting, that we should try to do one whole system, spend the money to do the one whole system, and create what I hope is going to be the efficiencies at the end. Again, efficiencies to business, but efficiencies to on the state side. We have people entering in all those data. Ledge Research, and I believe it's in your notes, did a project for us. They couldn't even figure out how much stuff overlaps because all the databases refer to different elements as different things. I don't think we have an efficient system right now, and I think it would behoove the state to move towards it. So I don't necessarily, although it might fail for practical reasons now, I don't think it fails for practical reasons in our future. Thank you.
Question?
Okay. We'll hold this bill and address it again later. I'll see. Is there anything else to do? Next meeting is Wednesday. Confirmation hearings and Senate Bill 262, Forest Practice Act, June 4th. And so, with that, we'll meetings adjourned at 4:05.